What drives someone to cheat, even when they're happy? This week, I sit down with Dr. Bruce Chalmer to unpack betrayal, gaslighting, hidden fantasies, and the brutal truth about modern love. This one gets real fast. Digital Dating Podcast with Anonymous Andrew. And I am excited to introduce our next guest. With me tonight is Dr. Bruce Chalmer. And Dr. Bruce Chalmer has a PhD in psychiatry.
Psychology.
Okay. I knew I'd screw it up.
Psychiatry is the ones who've been to medical school. I haven't been to medical school.
Okay. Psychiatry, but that's just as important. And he also has a podcast called Couples Therapy in 7 Weeks, and he does that with his wife.
In seven words. I got to tell you the 7 words, but go ahead.
Yes. 7 words. Okay.
Yeah, right.
This is called, I did my research in like 30 seconds. And he is an author of 3 books?
Yep.
Okay. And then he'll tell us what his latest book is, if you'd like to tell us now or whenever you're ready.
Sure. Yeah, the latest one is called Betrayal and Forgiveness. If you people are seeing any part of this on video, Betrayal and Forgiveness, How to Navigate the Turmoil and Learn to Trust Again.
That's my latest one. I like that. And I'm going to tell the audience, because we're in season 3, which is really about navigating the dating world. But when I saw Bruce's profile, my audience knows, the ones who are long-term, that my last relationship was filled with infidelity, trust issues, gaslighting. I was codependent with her. And I saw Bruce's bio, and he seems to, I don't know if you address this in your book, but the idea of trusting again, when you get your heart broken by somebody that you are just head over heels over, and of course, in my case, it was my fault. I stayed too long. I stayed way past the expiration. And I don't want to rehash my old relationship. This podcast has been about that for 2 years. Mm-hmm. But I think I need a new perspective from somebody who has your qualifications. You certainly qualify. So tell us a little bit about how you got into this, and you could talk about your podcast, and you have a practice, couples therapy.
Yes, I do.
Tell us all about yourself.
Sure, happy to. So I've been in practice now, in private practice, for just about 30 years, almost exactly right now. I started in February of 1995, so it's been 30 years. And in that time, I've worked with lots of individuals and lots of couples. And for the last 8 or 10 years, I've really been focusing much more on couples. And really, I enjoy that work. The more I've worked with couples, I mean, as you mentioned, I've written 3 books. I wrote a book that was based on my little 7-word formula, which is kind of silly to say that you can summarize it all in 7 words. Early in my practice, I was at a consultation group with a few colleagues, and we were on the way out the door, and one of them turned to me and said, "Hey, how do you do couples therapy anyway?" Which is sort of a silly question when you're walking out the door, you know. But I said, "Well, you know, I've sort of given that some thought, and I think basically what I'm telling people is, if you boil it all down, you know, all the techniques and all the stuff we learn in graduate school and all that stuff, if you boil it all down, you're basically telling people, be kind and don't panic." Well, that's only 5 words, be kind and don't panic. And I started sharing that with other folks, and they would say, "Well, that's a really interesting summary. I can see why that's kind of a nice summary of things. Because if you're panicking, you really can't be kind. If you're panicking, you're not able to, you know, hear the other person and deal with differences. You're just kind of freaking out." And then people would say, "Well, okay, so how do you not panic? If, you know, that'll help you be kind. How do you not panic?" And I realized, well, I haven't got a good answer to that, but I know what I see when I observe the couples that seem to do well. When they're coming in and there's been infidelity, or there's been some other kind of betrayal, or there's been just all sorts of difficulties and they can't seem to talk about anything without getting into a fight or getting into a deep freeze. The couples that do well are the ones that are manifesting. And I hunted for a better word than faith, but I came up with faith. And I don't mean religious faith necessarily, but we're manifesting that sense that, you know, this existence business is basically right, even when it sucks, even when it's painful. There's something right about it. There's something meaningful about it. We better learn from it rather than just trying to dissociate from it. The couples that came in and said, "We just want to go back to the way it was," never works, because they can't go back to the way it was.
No. No.
And they shouldn't go back to the way it was. That's what got them to where they were.
That's where it was broken in the first place. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, so I observed this and I came up with this formula. The first book that I wrote, which is called Reigniting the Spark, is actually organized around those 7-word formula. The podcast I do with my wife, Judy Alexander, is not a therapist. She's a retired educator. But and for the benefit of your listeners, I can't resist sharing. She grew up in Long Beach, which is where you're located. I just think that's really cool. Anyway.
Yeah.
So we had no idea until this evening that we had that in common.
Small world.
Small world it is. But in any case, we do the podcast called Couples Therapy in 7 Words. And that's what it's based on. But so I wrote that first book. Then I wrote another book with a rather snarky title. The second book's title is It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy is Wrong. That's a rather snarky title, if I do say so. But what I meant by it is just teaching people communication formulas is not going to help them actually function better. You know, trying to behave the way people behave when they are functioning better won't make you function better. The people who are doing well in a relationship are communicating well because they're functioning better. They're not functioning better because they're communicating well. And so therapies that just say, well, we're going to teach you how to communicate with each other tend to be a waste of time. That's the thesis of that one. It's all about how to make use of therapy. And then I wrote this most recent book. So it came out a little over a year ago, or just about a year ago. And that book, I realized a huge chunk of the folks that I work with, and I don't have an exact number, but not much under half of the couples that I work with, when they come in, are dealing with infidelity specifically. And lots of other people are dealing with other kinds of betrayals as well. There's other kinds of betrayal, you know, betrayals where somebody is like totally financially irresponsible.
Financially irresponsible, gambling.
Right.
Exactly. Porn. Yep. Porn addiction today is a big thing.
All of the above. So
yeah.
That book actually covers not only couples, but also covers people like, you know, siblings who are having difficulty getting along, or parents and adult children, all sorts of betrayals that people experience, and how to recover from that in a way that you can actually feel not only healed, but actually kind of grateful for the process.
And whole.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm known for, I should really have played baseball or be a pitcher. I'm known for my curveball questions. So I'm going to throw you a curveball question.
Feel free.
It seems to me that the human race is the dominant species on the earth, right? We can agree on that.
We certainly think so. Yep.
Yeah. And we have been around for, you know, today I read an article that they think we've been around longer than they found some skeleton bowls in Thailand that go back 10,000 years prior to, they thought. Anyway, we have been around, let's just pick a number, 100,000 years. And we have obviously progressed a lot in that year, because look where we are today. In the past 30, 40 years, the tech world has just exploded. What has changed from 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 50 years ago, where it is in our DNA to need a partner to procreate, because that's part of humans and all creatures. All creatures are here to procreate so they can reproduce, they die off, and their offspring live. Yeah. So it would seem that it'd be natural for humans to just, bond is not the word, is to find someone attractive and say, and like each other. You have a conversation. I say, I think I like you. And then they get married. And that's the way it was 50 years ago. I remember my parents, how they met. And my parents were married till death did them part. They were long-term, 55-something years. And they both passed away. And yada. What happened? Why is it so hard today for couples? Well, first of all, why is it so hard today to find a partner? And second is, why is it so hard if you find that partner to keep that partner?
Yeah, yeah. Great questions. And it's not like I can give you I have a few ideas on the subject, but there's a zillion ideas.
Yeah, no, I'm not looking for, I don't expect you to solve the solution, but the question, but just your perspective on what you think might be going on.
No, I'm happy to. You know, it's interesting because I've been in practice now 30 years. So I have enough of a time that I've seen changes even in that 30 years. But if you go back, I'm in my 70s. I'm 73. So I remember the 1950s. My parents also were, you know, until death do us part. It was very little divorce in our general circle.
And that's another question. The divorce rate is just skyrocketed. Yeah.
Well, actually, it's come down a bit
I did hear that. Yes.
Yes. What happened? And of course, a couple of reasons why the divorce rate came down. I'll come back to that. I want to address one, just kind of go way back. It's like, yeah, we are mammals. We reproduce sexually. You figure we need to pair up at least to reproduce. But what is this bit that humans do where we insist not merely on pairing up and reproducing, but staying together? That's, you know, not all mammals do that. Lots of mammals, there's no such thing as fathers. They're sperm donors.
Right.
That's
right.
It. But we have bonded, and, you know, anthropologists have written about that. There's a woman named Helen Fisher who just died in the past few months.
Oh, did she? I know, yeah. Helen, sure.
Yeah, she died, and she wrote a lot about the anthropology of mating and love and sex and, you know, sort of practices, yeah, of how people pair
I
up.
I loved her. She was great.
One of the things she pointed out, which I really enjoyed in one of her books, she pointed out that what humans do, if you boil it all down, you know, and she looked at cultures all over the world, many of which were isolated from other cultures for millennia in some cases. And she compared human cultures to other primates, you know, other apes and stuff like that. And she said, what humans seem to do that's more or less universal, she said, it's serial monogamy with clandestine adultery. That's what we do. We don't just do monogamy. And you look around, obviously, monogamy isn't, everybody doesn't do monogamy. You know, lots of people do.
No.
But many people don't. Lots of people do serial monogamy, which is to say they will have one partner and maybe for whatever reason that doesn't last, and then they have another partner, but only one at a time. That's serial
monogamy. One at a time. Okay.
But she said, even whatever your culture does, there's always clandestine adultery. It's clandestine for the fact, which is to say, yeah, it needs to be clandestine because if it was allowed, that would cause problems. But if it didn't exist, that would cause problems. She just explained it from an anthropological perspective. So, you know, when people say, oh, we're not programmed for monogamy, no, that isn't true. But when people say, well, yeah, but we're not programmed for perfect monogamy, well, that's probably true too. Just look around. Obviously, we don't do monogamy perfectly. Plenty of people cheat.
And I agree with her, and I think it's fantastic. What I don't understand, because I would do this. So if I was in a relationship and I'm 1 year, whether it's married or living or shacking up, whatever, and things were going well and going well, and then all of a sudden one day I woke up and I said, I'm bored. Could be because she is not giving me enough sex. Maybe because I'm just throwing things out there. Maybe she put on a lot of weight. Maybe she's out shopping all day and spending my money, whatever. All sorts of different reasons. And I'm just saying, all right, I'm done. I'd like to. So I would go up to my wife or girlfriend and say, this is not working for me anymore. And I'm going to disengage from this relationship. And I'm not going to go cheat. I'm going to say, honestly, I'd like an out. I want my get out of jail card free. Yeah. And I'm going to go out and experience. So the last relationship I was in, that's exactly what happened to me. After 1 year, she said to herself, but not to me, I'm going to go explore other men.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to tell you about it. And of course, I found out about it and I got lied to, gaslit, cheated on, deceived, yada, yada. Why can't humans just be honest with each other and say, this isn't working. Maybe we should just go our separate ways. But yet, no, they stay together and continue to hurt each other by clandestine affairs and gambling and porn addiction. And the list goes on.
You know, I deal with this every day in my work, actually, with couples. There's a lot of reasons why people cheat. I'm not justifying it. You know, it's funny when I'm working with couples and there's been infidelity, it is incredibly rare that there's any disagreement about whether it was wrong or not. Everybody seems to agree it was wrong. You know, when they're sitting with me, it's clear that they've figured out, you know, the one who did the cheating is feeling bad about it. They're saying, yeah, I shouldn't have done it. The one who was cheated on, of course, is not only feeling bad, they're also often feeling furious, but there isn't usually a lot of disagreement about whether it's wrong. Occasionally, I'll meet a couple where they can't agree on whether something was cheating or not. That's interesting. And that-
Yeah, what, there's a gray line?
Yeah, because that's changed a lot in the internet era, of course, because it used to be, okay, maybe somebody would be looking at porn and almost always men, not always, but almost always men in the day. And it would be like magazines and stuff like that. And the woman often would find that objectionable for a variety of reasons and would be really hurt by it or you know, pissed off about it or whatever. That was fairly straightforward, but that was porn. It wasn't the same as going out and having an affair. Now on the internet, people can have internet relationships with actual human beings. And that feels a lot to most people. That feels a lot more like cheating than merely looking at porn does. You know, there are
degrees. And there's a term for that. Emotionally attached or emotionally in love, but sometimes they never even meet, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, of course. Yeah. And they may even be having internet sex.
Sex, you know, exactly.
They're doing sexual stuff, even though they're never in each other's.
So if I was a wife and I caught my husband either masturbating to porn or having sexual chat, like you sex texting or sending pictures, he's doing that. Why?
He's often doing that because sometimes it has a kind of addictive quality to it. It's, you know, it's because it scratches an itch of a sort. He is often doing something like that because he's excited by it and doesn't want his wife to know about it precisely because he knows his wife won't approve. There are plenty of couples where the wife would approve, would have no problem with it, by the way.
I've had a couple of relationships with women watch porn with me, which was great.
Exactly. Yeah. So that it varies with a couple, of course, what their values are. I was just having a conversation earlier today with a couple, actually, where the wife was really upset about the husband's porn use. He had, years ago, had had an affair, and they had worked through that, and she was really more offended by his lying about it than she was offended about it, about his using porn. You know, she didn't think of that as an affair, but she said, he knows I disapprove, and he was hiding it from me for years, and that was really bothering her.
Let me ask you, this couple that you're referring to, after the affair, did they start resuming intimate relations again?
Yeah. I don't think they'd ever stopped, you know, that while he was having the affair, yeah.
But yet he felt the need to still go to porn.
Yeah, it's yes. And they're not the same thing. Do you know what I mean? That why do guys use porn? It's not the same thing as actually having sex with a real human being. It's a lot easier. So there, you know, women tend not to understand that, of course. Women will take it very personally and say, I can't compete with that. Why are you getting excited by that person? And men will tend to say, it's not a person, it's an image. And men tend to find sexually explicit images, you know, exciting.
In between my relationships, of course, I'm always open and honest and vulnerable on here. Yeah, I used porn many, many years. Not anymore today, because it's overwhelming. Mm. But there were times in between relationships when I needed, you know, to what do they call that? Bust a nut, whatever the term is.
Yep.
But when I was in a relationship with somebody, and my parents, because they stayed together and they were monogamous, that's what I was taught. So old-fashioned values. I never cheated. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not entirely true. During my alcohol years, I cheated. But I'm going back to 20, 30 years ago. I was never looking at porn during this last relationship. I wouldn't. Like, she didn't come over every night of the week. We saw each other maybe two or three times a week. I wasn't watching porn the rest of the week. And if I did, it was pictures of her. She loved to take nudes. So I would masturbate to her pictures, you know, but it wasn't Pornhub or RedTube or whatever's on there today. But I may be a unique unicorn. I don't know.
No, not at all. The people vary all over the map on how they feel about that and the degree to which they feel it's a violation. Do you know what I mean? Because like you said, you've had been in relationships where you watch porn together. That's certainly not cheating.
Yeah. And I can only think of one or two women that were really engaged. They really enjoyed the porn. Some of them watched it to appease me and get in the mood. But then the porn, 10 minutes later, it was off. But it was just like a form of foreplay. Yeah. That's all.
Yeah. That's kind of stuff, you know, that essentially what gets people through this, and porn is a great example of it, and it's what we were talking about with the couple this morning. What gets people through this kind of crisis when they're feeling this sense of, you know, a kind of betrayal, it's like, wait a minute, you're doing this and not telling me, is if they can talk about it. I know that's kind of a simplistic answer, but I'm a couples therapist and that's what we do, you know. If they can actually talk about it without freaking the fuck out, basically, then it becomes possible for them to figure out, okay, what am I okay with? What am I not okay with? You know, sometimes what a couple will find out when they're actually willing to share what they like, you know, you're saying, why do guys do that? Why do people have the fantasies they have? You know, there's one of on the podcast my wife and I do, we interviewed several people. There's one woman we interviewed is sort of a specialist in sexual fantasies. And it's fascinating the way her name is Artemisia Divine. She has what she calls the divinery method. It's fascinating stuff where she talks about the role of fantasies. And a lot of fantasies that people have are not at all real life things that you'd ever want to do. but you can incorporate the fact of those fantasies if couples are willing to talk about it without freaking out. They can learn about themselves and each other.
It's interesting you said that because I pressed her. I know that everybody has a secret dark fantasy, and sometimes they're comfortable sharing it, sometimes they're not. The last girlfriend, I said to her one day, you must have something, and she looked at me and nope, no fantasies, no fan. And I kept pressing and pressing very gently over the course of a couple of months. And one day she said, okay, I have something. And it was really benign. And I almost laughed, but it was something she had never done. And it was just a position in intercourse that she had always wanted to do. And apparently either her husband or no other guy ever did it. And I laughed. And then I found out that she had a stripper fantasy, that she wanted to be a stripper. And then I found out later she was stripping. But so I said to her, I'll buy a stripper pole and you can dance for me. And she laughed and she said, you would do that? And I said, if that's your fantasy and you want to do that, I'll make it happen for you.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if this was true of that particular woman you're talking about, but for a lot of folks, the reason they're not saying it is they're afraid of your reaction.
Right.
You know, they're afraid.
Or they're ashamed of it.
Or they're ashamed of it, exactly.
Or it's illegal.
Right. And many, many fantasies are incredibly illegal and evil and wrong. You know, rape fantasies are really common, and fantasies of being raped. And I've talked with lots of women. I think the statistics on that is it's a substantial proportion of women. It's like in some things I've read, it's over half of women will have fantasies of being either raped or taken, you know, overpowered. Not a single one of those women literally wants to be raped. What Artemisia Devine points out is, isn't it interesting how in those fantasies, what the supposed rapist does to them is exactly what they like? In other words, it's a fantasy of being in control, even though it seems like you're out of control, of being so desired that somebody can't stop themselves. That's a fantasy that you wouldn't want to actually live out in real life, but that could be incorporated into a couple's play. That could be incorporated into their understanding of each other in ways that really enrich their sex lives.
The same way that BDSM, light beat, like hand, like tied up, but as long as you have a safe word.
Yeah.
I want to tell you a story. In my late 20s, I was seeing this woman from Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. And I worked in the city, so she wasn't far away from me. And one night we were out, and I don't remember why, but hotels were where we had our sex, because I don't remember the details. And one night she said to me, we talked about fantasies, and she said, I'd like to be raped. I was like, absolutely not. It's not my thing.
Yeah.
I abhor that. And she begged me, please just indulge me. And there were some drugs involved and I was drunk and I said, okay. So we played out this scene where, I crept up behind her and I grabbed her and I forcibly put her on the couch and I started to rip her clothes off. And of course, during the whole time, I was very uncomfortable. Uh-huh. But this was a woman that I was in relationship with and this is what she wanted. Do you know that she took it to the extreme and fought back?
Uh-huh.
And I was on top of her, holding her hands down. She broke free and landed a punch on me. She went up and punched me.
Uh-huh.
So her fantasy wasn't just getting raped. Her fantasy was getting raped and fighting back.
Yeah.
And she forgot to mention that to me.
That might have been good for you to know. I met a couple of years ago, early in my practice, so probably 25 years or more ago, where it was, they were in their 50s, a couple in their 50s at the time. And the woman was this sort of take no prisoners lawyer, you know, the kind of person that you don't want to say the wrong word to her or she'll tear you a new one, you know. She said, and her husband was this big, gruff kind of, you know, construction worker type guy. And she said she had figured out in her 30s that she was a sexual submissive. And not only did she need to be dominated, which her husband sounded like you. It's like he didn't have it in him to actually do something that might hurt her. He couldn't stand that idea. But she didn't need that. She needed to be actively humiliated. She needed to be so put down and humiliated. And her husband he agreed to pretend. They would go to sex conventions and things like that, where they would meet other people who would do things like this. He could pretend it, but as soon as she sensed that he was doing it to please her, it wasn't working. He needed someone who got off on humiliating her. So what their solution, this was 25 years ago, in the early days of the internet, their solution was to go online and find a guy, and this was before video, they were doing this via messages, you know, find a guy who would order her to do these various things that would be, they were awful, awful things, some of which landed her in the emergency room, actually. And she would do them. And her husband knew that she was doing this because that's what she needed to feel okay sexually, which is really kind of bizarre. But, you know, I learned a lot working with them.
But that's not uncommon, especially among the, from what I understand. So like the Wall Street guys, the lawyers, professionals, they like to be humiliated. So during the day, they're very powerful men. They run the world. But at night, they want to be, you know, tied up like a baby and beaten. And that's very common. So very interesting. Wow. Okay, what a way to open up a podcast. Okay, boy, we jumped right into it. Let's talk about, I want to get into one of your books or some of your books. And again, I don't want to dredge up my old relationship, but there are many, many, many people out there that are going through infidelity, deception, gaslighting, and codependency. And those are four big terms, so we don't have to lump them together. One of you, in your bio, and this was AI generated. So to the audience, Bruce and I were matched on this. We call it pod match. And he comes to me and says, I do this and I accept him and yada, yada. One of the AI said that you could ask Bruce the following question. So I'm going to ask you a question and see, I don't know if this is, I read some of them off to you. What are not, boy, I love when I can't read my handwriting. What are some of the causes of deception and infidelity in today's relationships or marriages?
Yeah. I think they're the causes of infidelity and deception, actually. And deception almost always goes along with infidelity.
Of course, hand in hand.
Hand in hand. It's the same reasons that that's been true for millennia, you know, that people are, look, we're sexual beings. We're attracted to other people besides the person that we've pledged fidelity to. And so the fact that we can be attracted means that some people are going to, you know, that the circumstances will arise where they will decide, I think I can get away with this. So they do it. And, you know, I don't mean to take such a cynical view. Sometimes it's in a context where the relationship, their primary relationship isn't going well. But you know what? Sometimes the primary relationship is fine. People will say, no, I love my wife or I love my husband. And actually, we have a great sex life, but I just couldn't resist, you know, playing around with this other person. There's all kinds of people now who are trying to find ways of, ethical non-monogamy, you know, the buzzword there.
I've had somebody on as a guest.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's interesting. I'm an old guy and sort of traditional. I look at it, and of course, I realize it's funny. Before I was a psychologist, I was a statistician. I actually have a master's in statistics. I actually wrote my fourth book. The first one I wrote, 1986, is called Understanding Statistics. So I go way back. My statistician brain says to me, well, I realize whenever I hear about polyamory from folks in my office, it's because it's a shit show. It's not because it's going well. Nobody ever makes an appointment with me just to tell me how well it's going. You know, it's funny how that works. So I don't get to hear about that. But why do people cheat? Because there's a zillion reasons. Sometimes it's a symptom of lack of intimacy in the marriage. And I don't just mean lack of sex. You know, one of my favorite topics to talk about, and I talk about it in several of my books, why do we pair up a lot of ways of understanding it? We are trying to fulfill two different sets of needs. We're trying to get stability and we're trying to get intimacy. And the skills you need for stability are very different from the skills you need for intimacy. And when you have a couple that is all about stability, you know, keeping things stable, keeping the anxiety level low, they're apt to not tell each other things that matter to them if they're afraid how the other person's going to react. And when that's what I mean by lack of intimacy. When that happens, the symptoms tend to be, well, my favorite metaphor on this, think about a plant, you know, that is planted in fertile soil and it sprouts and it starts to grow. Somebody comes along and paves a sidewalk over it. Well, intimacy is the energy for growth. If somebody paves the sidewalk over it, it's going to try and crack the sidewalk. And often affairs are a way of cracking the sidewalk, metaphorically. It's a way of saying, this is too painful. This lack of connection is too painful. Something has to happen. Sometimes it's an affair. Sometimes it's just fighting about everything and nothing except what they're really worried about. Sometimes it's deep freeze. Different couples have their styles. But often infidelity is happening in a context, again, I'm not justifying it morally, but it's often happening in a context where there's a lack of connection and somebody's feeling frustrated and they start to justify it to themselves.
From my experience as being married twice and also just from knowing human nature, you know, a young couple, 27, whatever, get married and they're happily married for several years and then come the babies. Mm-hmm. And then mommy And maybe daddy is taking care of the babies, but daddy's off working. Mommy might work too. So mommy comes home from work and she's exhausted, but she's got to feed the baby. Maybe there's a nanny, maybe there's not. So the couples don't make time for each other to nurture their relationship.
Yeah.
So they both get frustrated. And by the time they go to bed, they're done. They're like, he doesn't want sex, she doesn't want sex, or he might want sex, but she's like, no fucking way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a lot of the marriages, or yeah, let's stick with marriages for this, break down is mm-hmm. when the children come along. Because my understanding is that you need to make date nights and you need to go yeah. out and nurture. If your family's going to fall apart, if you and your wife, if the husband and wife don't nurture that marriage that they, like 5 years ago when they looked at each other and said, to vow, to death do us part, whatever. You know, nobody in the vows should be until babies do us part, because babies will come along and fuck everything up.
Oh, yeah.
And I have three boys, so I know all about it. And
so do I actually have three boys. Interesting. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, okay.
That's a phenomenon that has actually been researched. I'll sometimes talk about it with couples that have young kids, the U-shaped curve of happiness. It starts off, you know, usually when people are relatively young, they're, you know, reasonably happy or happy to be doing what they're doing or whatever. They have kids and it goes down. And then when the kids finally grow up and leave the nest, it goes up again. And you got to get through that period of time. And of course, there's all kinds of wonderful rewards of being a parent, and we're both parents, and I certainly know that, but there are also incredible stresses involved. So, you know, that idea of date night is an interesting idea, because we just interviewed somebody on our podcast a few weeks ago who was telling us, and he didn't make this up, he gave credit to some other person he saw it from. One of the ways that you can actually pull off date nights, the idea of date night is a great idea, but it's incredibly difficult to do. Busy lives, like all the things you just said, people are exhausted. It's hard to do. He said what this person was advising was you set the bar really low for what you mean by date night. All they mean, and this guy said he and his wife do this every Wednesday night. All they mean by date night is after the kids are in bed, all they do is they set aside, if they can manage an hour, it's great. Sometimes they can't manage an hour, but half an hour, whatever, where they're not looking at screens. They're just sitting with each other. And there's no requirement that they be even talking. There's no requirement that they be having sex. There's no requirement of anything. It's just they just get to hang out with each other and kind of chill out and, you know, maybe have a glass of wine or not, or whatever, you know, whatever their favorite thing is to do. But set the bar really low. And that's what lets people have date night.
And I like that idea, because I think there's a lot of pressure on date nights. You think, yeah. Oh, I got to take my wife out to dinner tonight, and which is a nice thing.
It's lovely, but you can't do it every week.
You got to get a babysitter. You got to, you know, especially some of these lawyers or doctors or whatever industry you're in, you're on the clock 24 hours. You're getting text messages. And when you go on date night, like you said, screens off, phones are away. So right before I hit record with you and I told my iMac and my iPhone, do not disturb. Mm-hmm. I do not want to be disturbed for the next hour. So that can be done with the date night. Just turn the phones. If you don't want to turn them off, put them on do not disturb. You'll get your messages after the hour. And it's simple as that. And yeah. And to your point, where if you want to stay at home and do that, put the kids to bed, make your wife a bubble bath and get in it with her. You know, and
whatever, whatever.
Something. Okay. All right. On to the next question, because this is my favorite, because I fell for this hook, line, and sinker, the gaslighting effect. And I know that gaslighting and narcissism and codependency are the buzzwords all over social media, but it's real. And I experienced it firsthand and didn't even know that I was experiencing it. So gaslighting is when you see something and you confront the other person and you have concrete evidence and you approach them and you say, this is just one example. I know that you did A, B, and C today. You told me you were going to the nail salon, but I happen to know my buddy saw you driving out to the mountains or whatever. Where were you? And the answer that you get is anything from you're wrong to your buddy is wrong to just some back-ass words, twisted, manipulative answer that leaves you pondering, maybe I am wrong.
That's the key. What makes it gaslighting rather than just plain old lying? You know, lying is way more common than gaslighting. Gaslighting is when they're actually trying to make you feel crazy. That's yeah, that was from the original movie back in the 40s, you know, Charles Boyer.
I was just going to tell you that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like that, I'm telling that, you something you don't know, right?
Well, okay. Yeah, that's many of your listeners may
well,
not
a lot of
that.
People don't know that. The yeah. younger generation has no clue where gaslighting came from. It came from
yeah, go ahead.
Was it an Alfred Hitchcock movie?
I don't. You know what? My wife would know that, and she's not in
okay.
the room.
Okay, but it was a play that came that became a movie, and the husband was stealing the wife's jewelry or something. And in that day and age, it was in the 20s or something. They used gas lanterns,
right?
And he would dim them in the house when he would want to go rob her jewelry, and she would say, "Hey, honey, the gas is dimming," and he'd say, "No, it's not. It's yes, in your it imagination."
Would,
something
would make
like
her
that,
feel
right?
crazy, exactly.
Make that's, her feel crazy, right? The,
yeah, a lot of times people use gaslighting as if it's the same as lying. Look, lying's bad enough. Gaslighting is a whole other step of evil because it's actually trying to make the other person feel like you're nuts.
And there's a level of skill to it because yeah. I've seen through gaslighting, but I have actually there was one incident in the last relationship where she came to me and said, "I'm tired of your paranoia that you accuse me of A, B, and C."
Yeah.
And she said, "If you don't go get some help, I'm leaving." So we went together to my therapist, who's a nurse practitioner, and they put me on Seroquel, and which I'm not unfamiliar with because I live with bipolar. But at the time, I didn't think I needed it. And I was on Seroquel for almost 3 months, which was just horrible. But she convinced me that I was so back-asswards that I was making up things or paranoid that she got me to take psychotropic medication, you know, and so it's real.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And finally, I came off the Seroquel and I said, whatever. Okay, let's talk about another buzzword is codependency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, not one I like to use a lot simply because it tends
to- You mentioned that.
Yeah, it tends to get used as a bludgeon. You know, people will say, "Oh, you're codependent," meaning, you know, what's the matter with you? It's especially tends to get used against women as a bludgeon, although I think as men as well. But the concept, of course, makes sense when you're in a situation where you somehow aren't able to recognize that you need to take care of yourself and attend right. to your own well-being when someone else is doing all kinds of things that are causing you a lot of damage and you're doing it out of dedication to them. And so that sense of kind of being stuck with somebody that is hurting you, but you feel like you can't do anything about it. That's when people observe that from the outside, they're saying, "Oh, you're being codependent."
I'm a recovering codependent. And although I don't actively have been treating it, but my therapist and I have been working on it, but I was a people pleaser. I am a people pleaser, but in a relationship, I will go out of my way to try to make you, my girlfriend, happy. And everything from flowers every weekend to gifts to anything that I thought that would just make her smile. And I stopped taking care of myself. It was everything about making sure she was okay because I was afraid to lose her. And if I lost her, I'm alone. And if I'm alone, I got to live in my own skin. So my definition of codependency is that you are so invested in the other person that you will do everything for them, nothing for yourself, and all because you're afraid to lose them. And then be alone. And sometimes that losing them is not, you're never, they may not have any intention of leaving you, but you have this fear of that they're going to leave you if you don't do A, B, and C.
And
I lived and went through many relationships doing that and to my detriment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is it's a very common phenomenon. And exactly as you said, when the fear of being alone overrides your ability to make sure that you're okay. And, you know, it's so interesting because a lot of what you said overlaps with just being a good guy. Do you know? Yeah. It's like, well, aren't you nice to and generous to want to make your partner smile? If you get two people in a relationship and they're sort of each falling over each other to make the other smile, well, they're doing fine if they're also not hurting each other and deceiving each other and causing all sorts of damage.
Part of recovering from codependency is learning that I need to love myself how I am, because when this relationship ended, I was broken and I thought I had no self-respect because I allowed her to continue doing what she was doing, the gaslighting, the lying, the OnlyFans, all that stuff. And I just kept looking the other way. And then I would approach her and talk about it. And I was gaslit, yada, yada. And it got to the point where my self-respect was at an all-time low. Like there was none. And I took the 2 years off to learn how to live in my own skin and not need a woman on my arms. And I've talked about this on my podcast. And something happened last weekend where I felt that I was getting sucked into a situation. So I met a woman on a dating app last week, and I reached out to her. I commented on something she had written, and we had a lot in common. And she saw that, and she immediately responded. And we were chit-chatting for maybe 2 days on the app. And I asked her for her, I said to her, I'd like to take this off the app. Here's my phone number. You know what she said to me? I am old-fashioned. So if you want my phone number, you need to ask me like a gentleman. And I thought that was interesting. That really got me, because that's my generation. And she was establishing a boundary, saying, I'm not going to text you. If you want to call me, because when I was growing up and you wanted a woman's phone number or a girl's phone number in high school, you would ask her for it. And then, right. So she's telling me, you just offered me your phone number and that's not acceptable. Like, you expect me just to text? She was really, I guess, an old fashioned chick. And so I this is funny. I ran to ChatGPT and I said, how do I answer this? And
you asked a bot. Wow.
I asked a bot. Well, I'm also doing some research into the AI world and how AI might help the dating community. And it was part of research, but I really wanted to see what's the best way. So it said to me, write this. Oh my goodness, how embarrassing, or forget something. I wish I could pull it up. But the bottom line was, may I have your phone number? And she instantly wrote back, yes, you may, and gave me her phone number. Mm-hmm. So that night I texted her on her phone number and said, how are you doing? And we had a couple of back and forths. And then I said to her, hey, maybe tomorrow night we could talk on the phone. I'd like to hear your voice. Mm-hmm. And she said, yeah, that sounds great. Now, this was like Friday. Saturday rolls around. I wait till later in the day. And I said, what's your plans tonight? And she said, well, I have my daughters coming over and we're going to watch a Netflix movie. But they told me they may go out like 9 o'clock and go party, they go dancing or something. And I said, that sounds like you might be free at 9. Can I call you? And she said, text me at 9 o'clock. So I texted her at 9 o'clock and she said, the girls decided not to go out. They're here for the night. So I'm not going to be able to talk tonight. And I said, no problem. How about tomorrow? Because the weekend, we're at whatever. Same thing. The next day I texted her and said, hey, can I call you tonight? And she said, you know what? I burned my hand today. And I'm in a really bad mood. And one of my daughters wants to bring another friend over for a slumber party. And this woman's 10 years younger than me. So I guess her daughters are still like maybe late teens. I don't know. Long story short was that she breadcrumbed me for 4 days about calling on the phone. Why give me your number? Because the texting could continue on the app. I wanted the number so I could pick up the phone and hear her voice. Mm-hmm. Long story short is by Monday, I went back to ChatGPT and I said, she's breadcrumbing me. And it gave me a great answer. It said, hey, something to the hello, her name. And it said, I should pull it up. But the last sentence was, why don't you reach out to me when your time permits or in your time?
Sure.
And leave it at that. But the point I'm getting at here is I would have never have done that 3 or 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. I would have been pressuring her. Mm-hmm. You know, why'd you give me your phone number if you're not going to talk to me? I would have lost self-respect. And I knew she was stringing me along. And between ChatGPT and my own recovery of being dependent on, I felt like I was already putting high expectations on this woman.
Yeah.
And I needed to take a step back and say, this woman she's playing with me in some way.
And, you know, it's interesting. I don't even think you have to assume she's playing with you. It could just be that, you know, for whatever reason, she wasn't all in. So she had given you your number, but she wasn't quite ready to talk to you. So she, rather than just say, not ready yet, you know, you picked up on the fact she clearly wasn't quite ready. So you said, hey, give me a call when you want to. That's fine.
And I haven't heard from her.
And you haven't heard from her, so she wasn't ready. So whatever.
Yeah.
So it goes. But it's, you don't need, I don't think you need to assume, there was this sort of manipulative quality to it. It could have been that the very things she said were actually accurate. Maybe she was also a little put off by your pressing. Who knows? You know, it's hard to tell.
But I tried so gently not to press. Like, so in other words, I didn't text her all day. It was 6 o'clock at night. I said, hey, if
so
you have
no
time.
Knowing. Yeah.
I'll really never know. Knowing.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a big question for me. And let's see, we got a few minutes left and then we got to start to wrap up. I love this one because this one really, I lived this. How can a couple regain, again, my handwriting, but something about how can a couple regain trust after infidelity or after deceit?
Well, that's my whole book right there.
Thank you. So all right, which you can segue into your book.
I'll give you the short form, you know. Yeah, it's the what you need, one way of saying it, you know, this is my favorite way of talking about it. What you need to be able to do to regain trust, before you regain trust, you have to be able to get to the point where you're not freaking out. And when I say forgiveness, really all I mean by forgiveness, I'm not talking about forgiveness having anything to do with the relationship, oddly enough. You may have heard this in the program or that, you know, people say this in different contexts. I'm talking about forgiveness as an inside job. I can forgive somebody who I don't trust at all. All I mean by forgive in that case is I'm no longer obsessed with, you know, I'm no longer thrown into anger or totally overwhelmed when I think about what they did or when I think
turmoil.
Yeah. You sort of get past that. And it's like, okay, matter of fact, I can get past that. That's what forgiveness means. Then you're not burdened by it anymore. That doesn't mean you trust a person. And, you know, one of my favorite examples is a woman I worked with decades ago now, where I never met her ex-husband because he was in prison at the time. He was in prison for having been incredibly violent to both this woman I was working with and her children. And it put her in the hospital several occasions, and she threatened her with that he would kill her if she told, you know, what had happened. And finally, she was able to make a safety plan and execute it, and this guy got arrested. And she was under absolutely no illusions that this guy would ever be safe. She thought of him as nuts, but she was able to forgive him. Forgiving him didn't mean she wanted anything to do with him. Forgiving just meant she wasn't mad anymore. She just figured, well, he's nuts. There's no point being angry about it. He was crazy. He's dangerous. I'll stay away from him. You know, it's any more than you'd be nuts at an alligator or something like that. It's like, well, I mean, you're angry at an alligator. It's like, well, it's an alligator. Be careful, you know? So forgiveness, to get to forgiveness is a process. It's not something you can do instantaneously. I talk in the book about three steps to forgiveness. It takes a while. It's not until you've forgiven in that sense, at least enough forgiven, that you can actually think about regaining trust. Regaining trust takes both parties, because both parties have to figure out, okay, what got us here was real and meaningful, even if it was like wrong, but it was real and meaningful. We better work through this stuff. And if you're able to do that and reach some understanding of each other, then maybe you can trust somebody. You can trust that, wow, we as a couple have learned from this, and we as individuals have learned from this, and so we're not going to be replicating what happened before. That's how you rebuild trust. But that is not a instantaneous process. That takes some time.
Yeah, no, because there were several instances during that relationship where I caught her and I forgave her, and she literally. I never will understand this woman. We took a trip to Florida, and because she was always going down there by herself. So one day I said, no, we're going together. So we booked a trip to Miami. We went to the Keys. We spent two lovely days scuba diving and doing all this stuff. And on the third day, I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to an AA meeting. When I got back to the Airbnb, and she was gone. She had packed everything up and left.
Wow.
And I tried to reach her for 4 hours, and finally I got a hold of her, and she told me she was on an Amtrak train and she was in Orlando, passing Orlando. So she was heading back to New York. And I said, why? You know, because she didn't leave me a note. She didn't tell me why she left. I have an idea. I know why she left, but whatever. I said to her, I can't do this anymore. This was already after a couple of cheatings and I caught her on stuff. I come home. Thank God my son lives in Florida, so I spent the rest of my vacation with him. I came home and I had a couple more days of my vacation. On the very last day she literally knocked on my door. Didn't even call me. And I opened the door and I was shocked to see her. And she said, can I come in? And she came in and she sat on this couch and profusely apologized and begged me to take her back. She took a checkbook out and offered to write the price of the airfare, whatever. And I'm going to say this very carefully, she gaslit me into getting her to come back or allowing us to be together again. And I don't know what her motive was, because clearly she was doing something without me. She was either, I think she was escorting down there or stripping at clubs down there. I think she used me to get down there. Long story short is, would something like that relationship have any chance of, like, could I have ever forgiven her and trusted her?
Well, like, I'm trying to, you know, making that distinction. Sure, you can forgive her, but I wouldn't trust her.
Right.
That's okay. The issue. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and with that sort of history, I can't imagine, I don't know, maybe you could, I don't know. I can't imagine trusting someone who had done that. I could imagine forgiving. You know what forgiving means in this context? It's saying, well, you know, who understands another person completely? Really nobody. We're all doing the best we can. Even when we're fucking up royally, we're all doing the best we can. You know, I'm not saying you can't criticize what people do morally. Of course we can. But in terms of what she was doing, she was, you know, feeling her way along like we all are. And the various forces that were operating within her, that's what they came up with. If you can just sort of say, well, I'm just going to have to accept that. This is not someone you want to trust to be with you and be monogamous with you, because she demonstrated repeatedly that she's not, you can't believe what she says. Yeah.
Like I said to you. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Like I told you before we recorded, I think she had gotten out of a 25-year marriage. She enjoyed the year with me to see. By the way, I was the first American gringo that she had dated because she was Latina. Mm-hmm. And I think, but after that, she needed to go out and validate with other men that she was still beautiful because her husband had cheated on her. I think I was looking for any way to save or salvage the relationship. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I even, to my codependent point earlier, I gave her a diamond ring. And I said, maybe if I ask her to marry me. And she said, yes. I took her to the Pennsylvania mountains. It's a Grand Canyon in Pennsylvania. It's not obviously the one in Arizona, but there's another one that's beautiful in the mountains of Pennsylvania. And I took her there. It's a historical park. And I arranged it with the park rangers. And we had a whole audience. And I got down on my knee with the valley behind us, the Grand Canyon. And she said, yes. And then 3 weeks later, we broke up. It was the most strangest thing. So, okay, we got to begin to wrap up. Uh-huh. Tell us about where we can find your books, where we can find your practice online, where we can find your podcast, all that good stuff.
So you can find information about my books and about my practice at brucechalmer.com. Just go to brucechalmer.com. You'll find a link there that'll also take you to the podcast, but I'll give you the podcast address as well. The name of the podcast is Couples Therapy in 7 Words. And so the shorthand podcast address is ctin7, that's the number 7, ctin7.com. So if you go to ctn7.com, you'll find our podcast. If you go to brucechalmer.com, you'll find all about my practice. Also, I have tabs on there to talk about my book. I have a blog there that has, among other things, has videos of our podcast episodes as well. So
great.
People can find out about me.
Bruce, it has been a delight. And thank you. You answered some very difficult questions and you cleared up some misnomers and myths. And we talked about some of the buzzwords that are flying around the internet today. And I really thank you for just for being here and helping us with this today.
Well, thank you, Andrew. It's been a delight for me as well.
All right. Have a good night. I'd like to thank Dr. Bruce Chalmers so much for stopping by. You know, it's amazing. Week after week after week, we have all these guests on, and I continue to learn. And I hope you guys are getting something out of these guests. All of the topics that we discuss, anything from, like, I just did an interview the other night for porn addiction, all the way up to gaslighting and grief and infidelity and dating apps, and it's all intertwined with the modern dating world. It has gotten so sophisticated in the modern dating world. For those who are my age, you might remember it wasn't like this 20 years ago. So it is about navigating the modern world, and that's what we're exploring. So, folks, if you're enjoying this podcast, this show, any of my shows, so let's go over them. We got the Digital Dating Podcast. We got the Cultimatum Podcast. And, of course, I launched recently the Weekend Rant. So if you're enjoying these at all, please, I urge you to hit follow, subscribe, and leave a review. And until next time, folks, ciao.